Okay, we might as well begin. Welcome to the sauna. Just think about it as a healthy place to be, not just an overheated place. I tend to sweat a lot even when it's not hot, so I'll sit in front of you and drip for the next hour. Welcome all. My name is Jody Kretzman. I teach at Northwestern University in Chicago and Evanston, public policy and community building, and I direct a little research center called the Asset-Based Community Development, ABCD Institute there. We work with people across North America and now five other continents to try to figure out what works to build communities. Let me just quickly check how many people were with us yesterday evening to get a quick introduction to that. Okay, let me just do a quick review for those of you who weren't. To be completely simplistic about it, what we have done over four decades of work with communities, particularly struggling communities, devastated communities in urban and rural areas across North America and now in the developing world as well, is to try to figure out with people who are doing successful things in tough situations, what works? Why are they succeeding? Why are they getting some stuff done? And it always sends us back to a fork in the road. And the fork in the road is either people in local communities can accept what the larger institutional context tells them to think about their communities, or they can reject it. And the successful ones reject it. The larger institutional context, government, the Ford Foundation, funders, the World Bank, always tells struggling communities to concentrate first on what you don't have, your emptiness, your deficiencies, your needs. In the case of an inner city neighborhood, your dropout rate and your illiteracy rate and your teen pregnancy rate and your crime rate. Count those up, have those studied over and over again, tell the powers that be how bad things are, and we will give you money, programs, experts, right? That is deficiency-driven development. And our finding, not to get too nuanced about it, is that it doesn't work. And that, in fact, what does work is the opposite. When people get very serious about rethinking what they've got, and we have been constantly surprised to see the... Is that going to be visible? Is there enough? Does it make sense to turn? Maybe not all the lights, but I think there's one set of lights that keeps the back ones on and these off. Is that better? Okay. We've been constantly surprised that when people do take a look at what they've got and start building their community based on that, they come back to these six categories constantly. And it's not, as I said yesterday, not rocket science, but it does help, I think, for people to think about communities in a much more sort of concrete way. The community is a thing that has ingredients, it has parts, it has things that you could put your head and hands around. Talents and skills of our people, our local networks of relationships, our institutions and professional entities, physical, economic assets, and our cultural assets. So asset-based community development, as opposed to deficiency-based community development, which is still the global standard, simply starts with this rather than the empty part of the glass. Not to deny that the empty part exists. Absolutely it exists. And we need to know about the problems and the challenges. The question simply is for community development people, which part do you start with? And the strategy is, do you start with the full part in order to begin to address the empty part? And then we think that that's what works best, partly because it's sustainable. Let me just summarize in a different kind of way some of the contrasts between the work that we and our colleagues across the globe now do and the kind of more traditional way of going about community building, community development. Here are a few of the contrasts. The community building model on the left is the one that we're sort of working with and trying to figure out constantly. We don't think we know all the answers to this, but the social service model is the more traditional way of going at stuff. And it starts with needs. Let's do needs surveys. Let's do needs assessments. But the other way of going at things focuses on assets. The more traditional way starts with definition of problems and a focus on problems, but we're more interested in trying to figure out where are the opportunities, even, again, in very tough situations. The old social service model has a charity orientation, hold out your hand, And if you can convince the powers that be and the resources that be that you're bad enough off, we'll start throwing resources and money and experts at you, rather than an investment orientation, which is much tougher for both the communities and funders and governments. For funders and governments, they have to be smart enough to know what in a local community and who in a local community is worth investing in, who can get something done. And from a community point of view, they have to get over how easy it is to tell the outside world how terrible things are here. It's pretty easy for folks to get good about broadcasting their deficiencies. It's a little harder to say, yeah, we've got challenges, absolutely, but let me tell you what we're going to do with our own resources to begin to address those challenges, and we need to have you invest in us. The traditional emphasis is on paid human service agencies, the people like clients, right? In the community building work, there's a renewed emphasis on voluntary associations, the black clubs and the women's groups and the church groups and the sports groups and youth groups. Mostly the social service model focuses on individuals. And let me be clear, we don't want to throw out the social service model, but we see that what works is to modify it significantly so that the emphasis becomes on the community as the sort of context in which individuals are made whole. The social service model, not surprisingly, wants to increase services. One of the hardest things sometimes for community leaders to understand is that one of the measures of a healthy community is the need for fewer services. So services decline as the community becomes healthier and able to do for itself. Julie, there's chairs up here.
Yeah, I was trying not to disturb.
It's okay. Well, I'm sorry about that. You just did. There's a different set of understandings about power in the old way of doing things. Mostly we're taking a look at people with credentials and people who are elected to office. And much more in the community building model, we're looking for people who are at the center of networks of relationships. Who are the highly related folks? We're not always looking any longer at programs, but people. Let's start with the folks and see what programmatic directions emerge out of their own reality and direction. And then we've got all kinds of words. This is the one actually we're going to be working with today much more. That all kinds of words in the social service model for people who are mainly defined as empty. And client is one of those, right? You talked about that, didn't you? I think in the original Greek, client means somebody who is completely powerless, somebody who is, in fact, on their back, than whom somebody else knows better. So we've got words for powerless, empty people, clients and recipients, and words like that. And we're much more interested in thinking about people as contributors, as citizens, as gift-filled. And that's really where we're going for the next little while today. We want to concentrate, I think, on how the work is connecting with what I'm calling inclusion movements, both in North America and internationally, that are beginning to come together and talk to each other, although there are a number of different starting points. So let me just say a little bit about that and then give you some, basically a series of examples and stories. And I hope we have a good amount of time to talk together, because my guess is that all of you are doing this work one way or another. I suppose, to be simple-minded about it, there are two recognized inclusion movements for people who are studying community dynamics. And I'll say a word about each. One, it has been existing for about a quarter of a century in Europe. It's particularly strong in the UK, to some degree in Australia, and it's generally referred to as social inclusion. And social inclusion is now a policy arena for lots of governments in Europe, UK, Australia. There are departments of social inclusion. And it's a very interesting sort of alternative way of thinking about what we often in this country would maybe talk about as social justice. And the idea is that injustice, as experienced by lots of people, is the experience of exclusion. It's the experience of being locked out from the economy and from the community and from the polity, in fact. So that the social inclusion movement in Europe has been concentrating on both class and ethnicity, and particularly in Europe and the UK, the dilemma is, what do we do about all these people? They don't have nearly as much experience as we do in the United States. This is one of the ways we're ahead of them in dealing with folks who come from elsewhere. So we've done a lot of work in Ireland, for example, where the dilemma is, there are a bunch of chairs up here, come on up, where the dilemma for the Irish folks is what do we do in Dublin when there are now 85,000 Dubliners who are Turks? Right? We've never had that before, right? And all over Europe, the folks in Northern Africa and other parts of the Middle East are now part, they're there geographically, but they're not there in terms of the society, right? So the social inclusion movement there is partly to how do you think about making those folks part of the fabric of the society. The other part of the movement in Europe and the UK and Australia is really sort of more economic. How do you take people on the fringes economically and begin to think about ways to include them at the more toward the center of the economic? So social inclusion is a big deal in Europe and to some degree Australia. It just now is seeping into the conversation in the United States. There was the first Washington, D.C. conference on social inclusion hosted by Health and Human Services in April. I went up and spoke at that conference, and it was it was an exciting sort of time of discovery for governmental leaders in the United States to have a sort of different way of thinking about their task and what their challenge is. So one of the fonts of the social inclusion movement is that. The other is, and I think this has been more important for me and for our work, has been the incredible work led by the community of people with disabilities. And particularly in Canada, but an awful lot of good work now in the United States and elsewhere as well. Let me just tell you a quick story about where some of the passion for the work comes forth in my own life. We have a close friend and colleague and mentor in our asset-based community development network named Judith Snow. Does anybody know Judith Snow? She's very famous in Canada. She's from Toronto. She's 51 years old now. She was born with the ability to move this finger and to breathe, and therefore with help to make noise, conversation, right? That's all she had. So she was in an elaborate contraption chair from her birth on. At the age of 21, Judith got a hold of a whole bunch of pills and attempted suicide. Thankfully, part of thousands of people, she failed. But when she woke up a couple of days later, she started asking herself, why did I do that? Why did I think that life was no longer worth living? And her answer, after a while thinking about it, talking about it with people, was, I did that because I recognized that I had nobody in my life who was not paid to be there. Right? Everybody around me was there as a paid professional helper. And so she then decided to dedicate the rest of her life, and has for the last 30 years, to making sure that didn't happen. First to herself, and then to anybody else with disabilities. So she invented a kind of a wonderfully creative tool in sort of social life called the Circle of Friends. Mm-hmm. And the Circle of Friends was a sort of self-conscious and active way of surrounding first herself, and now thousands and thousands of other people have done the same thing, with people who were not professionals, but who were, sure, maybe first family members, but, you know, the person at the drugstore they ran into, or the waitress at the restaurant when they sometimes went out, or the gas station attendant, or the neighbor down the street, and began figuring out ways to organize those people as a circle of support. And along that organizing process came the gradual invention of what's called a path process. So there is now a kind of a, I hate the word, but a set of activities. I was going to say technology, that's not right. But a set of activities with folks with disabilities where a guided path with, it's called person-centered planning sometimes, and the person is at the center of the planning process. And she or he gathers the circle of friends and goes through a kind of process of discernment about where that person wants to go. What do I really want to do 5 years from now? Where do I want to be in my life 5 years from now? Is it about some work opportunities? Is it about more relationships? Is it about, you know, a living situation that's more independent? What is it about? And the circle of friends then goes on this planning journey with the person, and then very carefully the friends pick a piece of the path that they can be helpful with, right? And so there's a team effort that's put together that moves somebody from being simply a client or a recipient to being somebody that takes charge of their life. So that process has really expanded in Canada, so that there is now not only ubiquitous person-centered planning with people with disabilities, but there is also now federal policy, reinforced by provincial policy, to fund person-centered planning and activity, so that the dollars don't go to institutions that lock people behind doors, but they go to the person. And the person can use it in ways that advance their vision and plan for their lives. Right? That has, for us, huge ramifications for all kinds of people who are marginalized in communities. And we've seen it now beginning to be worked with people on welfare, with people coming out of prison, with young people in trouble, with new immigrant folks who have no circle of friends in the United States when they come here. And it's a very, very powerful way of going. Let me tell you one other story about the disability community that sort of has shaped the way we think about this. In Chicago, my town, there's a wonderful neighborhood called Logan Square. Anybody know Chicago? You know Logan Square near Northwest Side, Dave, right? Mostly Puerto Rican community, working class, with a very, very active Alinsky-style community organization, sort of slug it out with City Hall, you know, drop rats on the mayor's desk kind of folks, right? Not afraid to battle at all, right? But they did an interesting thing that was a little bit out of character some years ago. They said, you know, we're doing some good work here on affordable housing, on job creation, on stuff with schools, but, you know, they said, there's a whole bunch of people we're missing. They're not coming to what we're doing. They're not part of what we're up to. And so they decided to be systematic about trying to involve folks who were not involved. And they had a series of about 8 meetings in church basements around the neighborhood where they invited people to come. And the agenda of the meeting was one question. And the question was a really interesting question. The question was, who are the strangers in our community? Who are the strangers here? The people who are in our community, but who we don't know, and nobody else knows them either, right? Who are the strangers? And so they made strangers lists, and they were really interesting lists of who people thought the strangers were. Some people, you know, nominated the gang kids, and other people nominated the police. Some people nominated the absentee landlords, other people nominated teachers who came in and taught left. But there was one group of people who made almost every list, I think actually every list. And it was a group of people who lived in three huge residential facilities filled with people with disabilities, right? Who had been in the era of deinstitutionalization, some of you remember that, taken out of the big mental hospitals and put into these facilities in the community. And folks in these meetings were saying, you know, we know there are people in those places because we sometimes see them. They're walking around the neighborhood together. They're probably going to sheltered workshops or something. But we don't know them. We have absolutely no relationship with them. So this is a very gutsy group, and they decided, okay, we're going to take this on. We're going to take on, they called these people the strangest of the strangers, right? We really don't know. So they decided to take this particular group on. The strategy they adopted was really interesting. They decided to hire a genius to lead this work. And the genius that they hired was a wonderful woman named Rosita de la Rosa, Rose of the Rose. And Rosita was a woman who had two major characteristics of her genius. One was that she was a person who, she grew up in the neighbors, she is a person who could never look at another human being and see emptiness, right? She sees only fullness in every other human being she ever runs into. And the second element of Rosita's genius for this work was she knew everybody in the neighborhood, and everybody knew her. She was completely networked. She probably had over 100 relatives around the neighborhood, right? And knew all of the folks in the businesses and the churches. And so Rosita started in on this work. What did she do? She did two things. The first thing she did was she started hanging out at the residential places. And one-on-one, getting to know the people in those places. And what she was looking for in each person she met was their gifts, their skills, their passions. What did they care about? What was the fullness here? The second set of conversations that she engaged in was with folks in the community. And she was, I think, in a sense, testing the capacity for the community to be hospitable. This was a hospitality test. You start talking to business people and church people and YMCA people and police people and hospital people. And then making matches, right? And her idea was, let's take people out of the treatment mode where they are surrounded only by professionals and connect them where the natural connections lead us so that they are now part of the community. Let me just tell you one of my favorite stories about that. She, at one of the places she visited constantly, she noticed, she was introduced to and noticed a guy named Frank, who she had trouble connecting with because Frank was a silent person, never said anything. And so Rosita kept visiting this place and talking with other people in the place who were verbal, could actually have a conversation. But she was, every time she visited, she would spend a little bit of time with Frank, sort of talking with Frank and talking with about whatever was on their minds, and, you know, the weather and the sports teams and the neighborhood and the new business on a block. And Frank would never say a word, but would seem to be sort of okay with that conversation. This went on for months. One time when Rosita came to visit, she finished talking to somebody else in the house, went over to Frank, and began her usual sort of patter with Frank. And all of a sudden, surprised Rosita completely, Frank gets up out of his chair and takes Rosita's hand, right, and begins leading her back into the back end of the house. And Rosita tells this story just beautifully, much better than I can. And she says, I didn't know what he had in mind. <That's right>. She got even more worried when it turns out that he was taking her to his room. He had a single room, no windows, a single bed, a dresser, and a chair. And so Rosita, a very gutsy woman, she goes into the room with Frank, and she sits on the chair, and Frank sits on the bed. Still doesn't say a word. And Rosita's wondering, why in the world did he bring me here? And so she's looking around a little bit, and it's a pretty dingy scene until her eyes light on the top of the dresser. And on the top of the dresser, there is the one thing that is clearly the center of life in this room, this pretty drab, small room. It's highly polished. Clearly some attention has been lavished on it. And it's a bowling ball on a kind of a stand on the dresser. And so Rosita, being a genius, asks the question of Frank, "Frank, do you like to bowl?" And Frank just lights up, smiles, goes over, gets the bowling ball, brings it over, puts it on Rosita's lap, right, and sort of guides Rosita's hand to stroke the bowling ball, right? So Rosita said, "Okay, I've got it. I've got the gift. Frank loves to bowl." So what does she do? She goes to her, she's completely plugged into the community, right? She goes to her cousin, Raul, who is the captain of a bowling team in the Puerto Rican Bowling League. And she says, "I have a new friend who really loves to bowl. Not somebody with disability. I have a new friend who really loves to bowl. Do you have any room on your team for..." So Raul says, "Of course not. It's the middle of the season. We're right in the middle of things. We don't have any room on our team. Get out of here." Rosita is nothing if not persistent. She goes after Raul some more and is so persistent that eventually Raul says, "Okay, we can't take whoever this guy is on our team, but bring him along and we'll let him bowl sort of alongside of us and after the actual official bowling match is done." And so Rosita starts doing that. And Frank comes along and at first is completely shy and begins bowling, not officially, with the team. And by the way, when he starts bowling, it's pretty clear that if Frank has ever bowled in his life, it has not been recently. Pretty much every ball is a gutter ball, right? But slowly it picks up a little bit, and he begins knocking down a few pins, and eventually he knocks down enough pins within a few months to begin to get a handicap, if you know how bowling leagues work. You know, you can sort of equalize stuff. When he gets a handicap, it happens that one of the members of Raul's team gets a job in an outer suburb and has to move out of Logan Square. And so there's an opening on the team, and Raul asks Frank if he wants to join the team. So Frank becomes the only Polish member of a Puerto Rican bowling team. Bowling league. So he begins showing up regularly and bowling for the team. And within about 8 months, Frank begins to speak. And but when he begins to speak, he doesn't speak in his native Polish or English. He speaks Spanish. And mostly he speaks bowling Spanish. So it was, you know, be a little hard to have a deep theological discussion with Frank at this point. But he slowly becomes more and more articulate, and he begins recalling some of his childhood Polish and some of his English, and it turns out that in fact he's trilingual, because he's now picked up some Spanish as well. And as he becomes closer and closer to the people on the bowling team, in the second year of his bowling in the Puerto Rican Bowling League, at the annual banquet, Frank is named Bowler of the Year. Shortly thereafter, he moves out of the residential treatment center, the house, and into a small apartment next to Raul's family. Raul has five kids. And it turns out another gift of Frank, besides bad bowling, is that he's a terrific grandfather. And that he begins relating to the kids and the kids to him, and becomes sort of the neighborhood grandfather. And so people are constantly bringing their kids around to Frank. And so Frank eventually severs his ties entirely with the residential home and becomes essentially a family member and a community member and a contributor to the Logan Square community. That happened about 55 times in the 5 or 6 years of work that Rosita did with the residential treatment centers. One other real quick story, I won't spend as much time on this, but what's one of my favorites. She finds a guy who also doesn't speak, but whose his name was Howard, whose major gift was a gregarious laugh and smile. He just had one of those ear-to-ear grins constantly, which made everybody around him grin constantly. So Rosita said, this is not hard. I know what this gift is about. This guy is a constantly happy character. So she thinks about the community. She's so smart about how she thinks about things. She said, now where is the saddest place that I know in this community where a gift of happiness could be really used? And so she takes him to the Norwegian-American Hospital. there hasn't been a Norwegian in this neighborhood for 50 years, right? But the Norwegian-American Hospital is still there. And Rosita thinks of it as a sad place. So she brings this happy character, Howard, in there and starts talking with the administrators about where Howard might fit. And they tried a number of different things before they really found the fit. And the fit was that Howard became the guy who delivers the mail to the various departments in the hospital, right? He's got the cart, and the mail goes to different departments in the hospital. And people in these different departments begin to look forward with great anticipation to Howard's visit every morning because he comes in grinning and hugging people, and it's the high point of the morning for people in the departments. It's such a high for people in the departments that they overlook the fact that Howard can't read, and that therefore the mail is constantly getting delivered. So the routine is, okay, let's enjoy Howard's visit. He'll leave us the wrong mail, but we'll sort it out, and we'll get it to the right department. We'll exchange mail. So I'm in there interviewing the hospital administrator a few months after this has been going on, maybe 6 months after this has been going on. And I'm asking him what he thinks about all this. And he said, you know, Howard's been a great addition in so many ways. His spirit is terrific. But he said, he has also solved one of my most intractable management problems. He said, I could never get these departments to get out of their silos and talk to each other. But now that they have misdelivered mail, they're constantly talking with each other, right? So Howard has solved one of my toughest management problems. He said, I couldn't be more grateful. So, I don't know what the moral is. I guess the moral is that there are unintended consequences on the positive side of spotting and mobilizing people's gifts. And the folks with disabilities, I think, have been some of the people who have taught us that most profoundly over and over and over again. Let me turn a little bit for a few minutes to tools. Because we're interested in the ways in which people are getting more and more systematic about this kind of an agenda, the inclusion agenda.
This question we're clear.
Yeah.
You're out.
Oh, I was chasing right away a fly. Thanks for including me.
Kind of beyond the peripheral vision there.
Yeah.
Quick question about the half full half empty.
Yeah, yeah.
We use that. But we use that in terms of asset.
Yeah.
You know, the idea is go to the community and help folks sort of take a look at what assets are in the community first. If you're going to go to the outside, it's for the top up or the top off funds, the bridge funds, the whatever you want to call them, gap assets. The problem side, so we don't even talk about half full, half empty. We talk about we're going to find as much as we can in terms of assets here, and then we're going to whatever we need to make it whole, we'll go someplace else.
Yep, yep.
The problem side is what I think you're talking about with the half-empty piece, and the problem side is part of the assessment process, the community-based assessment process, but what we've run into is that in a consumer-based society, you know, folks are interested, they've been taught to look at the product,
yeah,
not the problem. So you'll hear people say, well, we need a community center, or we need affordable, well, that's the product. That's the project. It's not the problem. So then it's a matter of how do we get folks talking about, well, why do we think we need a community center, affordable housing,
yep,
blah, blah, blah. What are the problems?
Yep.
So how have you applied your model in those contexts?
Well, I think you're asking exactly the right question. I mean, I certainly agree with all of the premises. You don't know what you need until you know what you've got. That's the principle here, mm-hmm, of the half full, half empty glass. But I think digging beneath the leap to an answer,
mm-hmm,
to a question of, okay, what's going on here? And also, I think the accompanying thing is having the conversation also include, what are you willing to contribute to this?
Mm-hmm.
So that it's not, we're going to tell somebody else what to give to us, a community center. It's, what do we have together to contribute to building a stronger community? And maybe that is going to eventuate in a community center. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's about a set of connections and processes and new relationships that lead in that direction. But I think that, you know, the tricky thing is to avoid, this is not exactly what you're describing, but I think fairly frequently, we run into situations where people think they are acting as citizens, public people, when what they do, mainly, is to come to public meetings and gripe, right? That being a citizen is griping about what other people don't do,
right?
And putting the responsibility elsewhere. I think this is the challenge here is to say, no. It's our responsibility in the community to take this on and to give what we've got to give. Maybe it's not enough to get the whole path trodden, but we're going to start, and then we'll know what we need from the outside. But I think it's the question of agency. It's the question of production. Who produces the outcomes? Is it the community folks that are the major producers of the outcomes? Or are they still in the trap of looking for somebody else to produce the outcomes?
How do we help folks identify outcomes that actually relate to issues, current community conditions in the community? And I think that's a dilemma as well.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Okay. Let me give you another quick couple of examples here. I want to make sure that we're clear that when we're talking about inclusion in this way, we are still talking about it in the context of the pervasive power of exclusion in very, very particular ways. We may need the lighting problem here again. I'm going to show you real quickly two examples, one of exclusion, one of inclusion. If we've got some time, we'll do some more on the inclusion front. But here is an actual survey put together by a state welfare department. I won't name the state, but all of our states now have welfare to work, right, is a requirement. So this is the state's idea of what a welfare worker needs to know about a person that she or he is interviewing for the first time who's starting that difficult path from welfare to work. Right? So after 20 minutes, here's what we think is really important to know about this person. Tell me about your inadequate housing, your limited job skills, the job seeking skills you don't have, your poor work history, how often you've been fired, or quit jobs, no recent work history. Tell me about your high rate of absenteeism, the lack of the high school diploma or GED, the training you don't have. Maybe here's a neutral question, how old are you? But you get back to the important stuff right away. Are you a pregnant or parenting teen, a single parent? You don't have any child care. You've got skills, but unfortunately they're not in demand. You lack reliable transportation, you have no driver's license or insurance, you've got sick dependents, you don't have the right credentials, it goes on and on. You don't communicate very well, do you? You're uncertain about your employment goals, they're unrealistic. you don't have the right clothes, tell me about your family problems. Then tell me about your bad eyes and your bad ears and your bad teeth. Tell me about other medical problems. Your friends and family won't be very supportive, will they? Tell me about your history of mental illness, your felony record, how often you've lost your benefits. And then, of course, now that we know everything that's important to know, please share any additional information necessary for developing a plan for achieving your training and placement.
But in defense of that state, I'm sure what they're doing is taking the actual language of federal law and putting that into the assessment, because that's what the federal law is
that's
looking
right.
for in terms of whether they're going to give you money
that's
to
right.
help this person.
That's right. That's exactly right. I think that's not true in all of the categories, but certainly in some of those categories. That's true. I think they've riffed on that a little bit and expanded some of those categories. Other kinds of reactions to that? Yeah.
I remember the mom who told me that she started smoking because that was a risk factor and she got more help.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right.
That was why she started smoking.
That's exactly right. Yeah. The more risk factors you can put out there, the more help you can get.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, let me just report that because people know we collect these things, we have stacks of them. This is not an exceptional thing. There are lots and lots of endless examples, actually, of people in pretty powerful institutional positions dealing with individuals who are vulnerable in a lot of different ways, as if their emptiness were their only reality. Right? There's no fullness there at all. And it's not just low-income people or people on welfare. We've got another stack of them from young people. It turns out that when young people get in trouble with the law, somebody from juvenile justice will sit them down and have a little conversation. How many times have you thought about suicide recently? How many times were you beaten as a child? Tell me about your drug abuse. Tell me about your alcohol abuse. Tell me about your gang affiliation, right? All of the nothing about tell me what excites you and what your skills are, what you can do best. We've got some now from the Immigration Department, where the Immigration Department sits down new immigrants and asks them about all the trouble they got into in their villages, in their countries of origin. I have noticed, as my hair has grayed, that this happens a little bit to older adults as well, that more and more one's encounters with officialdom are about what you can't do anymore. Tell me what's broken now. Didn't used to be. The most unfair question I think I ever get is, tell me what you used to be able to remember that you can't remember now. I don't know, I can't remember.
Why I came to you for help in the first place.
That's right, that's exactly right. The general point is that there is a fairly significant institutional set of forces whose job it is to reinforce the labeling of people as primarily empty, deficient, needy, and problematic. And those forces have an awful lot of clout behind them. They come out of professional training in universities. Graduate degrees teach people how to do that. And I think it's fair to say that they are so difficult to combat because it would be easier if they were doing this out of evil motives. But they aren't. They're doing it not just because the federal categories exist, but because there's a logic here. You know, if we want to help, don't we have to know what's wrong? That's the logic, right? Which is pretty unassailable. But it doesn't get to the unintended consequences of the continuing debasement of human beings by defining them entirely by their emptiness. So the joy of this work is that the stacks of stuff that are about debasing human beings are now dwarfed by the stacks of stuff that are the opposite. So let me just show you a couple of those, maybe starting with my favorite. This is a survey one page, 20 minute, just like the welfare survey, one-on-one. But it's from a soup kitchen. Roland, this relates to your question about homeless people a little bit. The soup, let me give you a quick background. This is the largest soup kitchen in Cincinnati, Ohio, in an inner city neighborhood called Over the Rhine, the toughest neighborhood in Ohio, lots of people say. In Over the Rhine, the largest African-American church in Cincinnati is called New Prospect Baptist Church. It's pastored by a wonderful colleague of ours named Damon Lynch. Reverend Lynch is a genius community builder. What happened was, some years ago, his church, which ran the largest soup kitchen, fed over 350 people a night. Big, big operation, 7 nights a week. What happened was a bunch of the leaders of the soup kitchen all at once kind of hit a wall together. And the wall they hit was, you know, it's important. It's a wonderfully important ministry to feed people. But shouldn't we, couldn't we possibly be doing more? We see the same people back here all the time. Couldn't we make more of a difference in their lives? And so they had a series of discussions about that. It was interesting where they came out. They said, we're not making more of a difference in people's lives because you can't make a difference in somebody's life if you don't know them. You don't have a relationship with them. Then they said, now wait a minute. It's not entirely true that we don't know the people we're feeding. We actually know a lot about their emptiness. We know a lot about the fact that some of them drink too much and others of them take drugs and some of them are jobless and some of them are estranged from their families. What we don't know anything about is their fullness. And so they decided to design a set of questions to get at the fullness of the people in the soup kitchen. And so what I want to show you briefly is the one page survey. I've got it broken up into two pages here. That they used to get at the full part of the glass. I love the language. I love the sort of sensitivity, the respect. Thanks for coming over. What's your name? Did somebody talk to you about what this gift exchange is all about? They called this set of conversations a gift exchange. What do you understand it to be? So they start with the idea the person they're talking to might have a thought about this. And then they state their own. Basically, we believe that everybody has God-given talents and gifts that can be used to benefit the community. I want to spend a few minutes talking to you about your gifts and skills. Before we get started, let me give you a small gift. So they had a little exchange at the beginning that got this idea of gifts on the table. And then they started talking about gifts, and they're going to talk about three categories: gifts and skills and dreams, right? So just as the community folks sort of decided there are these six categories of assets in communities, here are people who say, if you want to know what the full part of an individual's glass, it's gifts and skills and dreams. Gifts are abilities we're born with. This is just the way they phrased it. What positive qualities do people say you have? So you don't have to brag. I'm not saying tell me everything good about yourself. Somebody once said I was a good listener. Right? So you can just report. Who are the people in your life that you give to? How do you give to them? When was the last time you shared with somebody else? What was that? You got a lot of answers about brown paper bags the night before and wine bottle, and that's fine. What do you give that makes you feel good? And they went to skills. Sometimes we have talents we collect in everyday life. We've learned how to do some things. What do you do best? What do you enjoy doing? If you could start a business, what would it be? Then, of course, they ask the ultimate vocational question that all young people should, and probably us older folks too, should listen to. What do you like to do that people would pay you to do? Ever made anything? Ever fixed anything? And then your dreams. What are your dreams? If you could snap your fingers and be doing anything, what would that be? And these, of course, are not people who have been asked about their dreams very often, if ever. I want to thank you. We're talking to as many people as we can. What we want to do is begin a wall of fame here in the soup kitchen, highlighting the gifts, skills, and dreams of as many people as possible. The ultimate goal is to find a way to use those gifts in rebuilding the community. So let me briefly describe to you what happened as a result of this process. I visited the soup kitchen about 6 months after this process had begun. They had done about 240 of these gift interviews by the time I got there. And I had visited the soup kitchen maybe 5-6 times before. We have done a lot of work with Reverend Lynch in that neighborhood, and we would always go over there for the meal and the night, so I knew some of the people. And I certainly knew the place. But I walked in this time, and it was completely transformed. Huge, old, abandoned industrial building was the site of the soup kitchen, one floor, and it had that, you know, the sort of off-white cinder blocks, right, that sort of looked dingy and dirty. That was what it was like every time previously, but not this time. Now, three of the walls were absolutely leaping at you with primary colors. And what they did was to cover the walls in big geometric shapes, triangles and rectangles and circles, squares, and inside each big shape was a person, starting with the person's, maybe a blown up photograph, the person's face, or they found some artists and the artists did caricatures of people's faces, person's name, and then a list of the gifts and skills and dreams of the person, right? So the walls became a kind of celebration of the giftedness and fullness of the people in the soup kitchen. But they wanted not only to have a static photograph of the giftedness, they wanted the walls to be alive and to be a community-building tool. So one of the ways they did that was they began a process that they called clustering. So every time they heard some repeated skill, for example, in the first 240 interviews, they found almost 40 people who claimed to have some carpentry skills, some carpentry background. So they said, okay, well, let's make a symbol. So they did a big saw, big brown saw, and put a saw next to everybody who had carpentry skills. And then they started having a brown, thick brown line that squiggled its way around the wall and stopped at every place there was another saw. So it introduced people who were carpenters or claimed to be to other people who were carpenters or claimed to be. And what I learned was, this was 6 months after the process started, that the previous month, about 15 of these guys, they were all guys, had in fact formed a carpentry co-op and were beginning to rehab apartment residences, particularly buildings that had been burned out in the Over the Rhine neighborhood. Another quick example, in the first 240 names, they found over 70 people who claimed to have musical skills. They had sung at some point, or they played an instrument at some point. And that was the explanation for why, when I walked in to the soup kitchen at the sort of just before the dinner hour, you know, served for about an hour, 15 minutes, hour and a half, something like that, on a little bit of a raised platform at one end of the hall was a 15-voice choir made up of people who had discovered each other through this process. And when the choir, it didn't have a huge repertoire, but when they had run through their 4 or 5 songs, they got off and were replaced by a 5-piece jazz quintet who had found each other. You know, it was not the best jazz quintet I've ever heard in my life, but they were lively and spirited, off tune. In another corner, the space had been turned into a children's corner because a lot of people had reported childcare experience. So all over the place, stuff was happening. And as I was wandering through here, saying hello to some people that I'd seen before, it was occurring to me that I was seeing something that I had never seen before. And so I had to ask some questions about it. And what I found out was this, that when they ask questions about skills, what do you do best? What do you like to do best? One skill got mentioned far more frequently than any other skill. More than half the people said, I love to do X. Any guesses?
Cook?
Yep. Next, Gloria. Cook. I love to cook. I cook a mean pot of chili. In a soup kitchen. And that, after they heard that over and over again, the church folks who were doing the interviews began thinking, you know, I think we may be hearing something that's not just about cooking. We're hearing people tell us over and over again, look, I don't want to be on this side of the table anymore. with you on the other side of the table cooking for me and serving me. Because as long as I'm over here and you're over there, you are a fully valued member of this community and I'm nothing. I want to come around on the cooking side and I want to be a contributor. And so when they understood what they were hearing, the church folks began acting on it. They were very serious about this work, and courageous about it. They ended up doing two things, both of which are really smart. They brought the 65 or so most active volunteers from the church, and actually it was a consortium of churches by this time, together. And they brought them together for a thank you celebration and a sort of rededication of the soup kitchen. And after thanking people for all of the work in the soup kitchen, they said, we're going to rededicate this soup kitchen, and we're going to, as we do that, we're going to rededicate it with a little bit different rule for people who come in to volunteer. We love your work. We're grateful for it. Please keep doing it. But from now on, when you come in to volunteer at the soup kitchen, come hungry. Everybody eats. Nobody comes to just cook and serve. And of course, they got a little pushback. You mean you want us to eat with those people? Yeah, we do. But by the time I got there, 6 months later, all of that had gone by the board. And what was happening now is that volunteers in the soup kitchen were bringing their families with them, right? And it was community meal night, right? And they were, in fact, all coming for dinner to eat with, quote, those people. And in fact, those people were no longer those people. Those people were our friends. And we were getting to know each other. The other thing they did then, besides, so they've shifted the way in which the volunteers thought about their work. But they said then, probably won't work to change the rules for the people who are coming in for a meal, because they're used to having rules imposed on them. They'll probably push back on it. They're probably right. So what they did was a very smart community organizing thing. They went back over their interview notes, and they chose the 20 most enthusiastic would-be cooks, the people who just sort of jumped out of their chairs and say, I'd love to cook. Went back to them one by one and said, we noticed you got really excited when you were telling us about your cooking skills. And it happens that we really have a need in the kitchen. Would you be interested in joining the cooking team? We would love to have your skills and talents back there. What the church people reported to me is that 19 out of the 20 said yes immediately and started showing up the first week to be part of the cooking team. And many of them started then coming multiple times a week. What happened then, according to the church folks, much faster than they expected, was that people waiting in line to get their plates started looking back into the kitchen and saying, what are our buddies doing back? What's Charlie doing in the kitchen? He should be out here in the line, right? No, Charlie works in the kitchen. He's helping make the food tonight. And so the immediate response was, do you need anybody else in the kitchen? Or if you're full in the kitchen, can I help serve? Or I notice this place gets a little messed up after the meal, I'd be happy to clean up, or I'd be happy to help with dishes, or I'm not working right now, I'd be happy to help pick up some food during the day. And that was the explanation for what struck me and puzzled me so much. Because when I was walking through the soup kitchen, and I've been in a lot of soup kitchens in my life, but this was the first one that I'd ever been in. I looked around, it's a room full of people, 300 plus people, and I couldn't tell who was who. I couldn't tell who was in for a meal and who was from the church. And the reason was, everybody was doing something. There was no distinction between givers and receivers. Everybody was both. It was a two-way street. Right? And as it sort of slowly penetrated my head, that has become for me a powerful image of what I think a healthy community is. A healthy community has nobody who is pushed to the margins by virtue of being labeled as empty and deficient and needy, and therefore becomes the served or the helped. Everybody is recognized as an actual and potential capacity-filled, gift-filled person, and the opportunity to give the gifts is opened up. So I think as community builders, whether we're talking about in congregations or in schools or in communities, the challenge is to think constantly in two ways. how do we find the multidimensional gifts, skills, passions of people who are sometimes excluded and on the margin? And then equally important, how do we find throughout our community the opportunities for people to give their gifts? It's not enough to find the gifts if the gifts are not mobilized in useful ways. I think that the conversation that followed on this visit with the church folks was really interesting because they were struggling with what's the language to talk about what we're seeing happening here, right? Said, we had language for the old stuff. You know, we were the helpers and they were the helpees, or we were the servers and they were the people who were being served, right? Or we were the professionals and they were the clients, right? All of the full, empty stuff. And so we're struggling, they said, with what's the language about this sort of equal power exchange thing. And they were just simply discovering, finally, the power of ancient, simple language. Well, what are we going to call each other? Why don't we call each other friends? Mm-hmm. Or why don't we call each other neighbors? Mm-hmm. Or why don't we call each other just partners? Right? So that was the transformation that was going on. Let me just one last reflection on this. This took me a while to sort of begin to think about. I think this is also a microcosmic experiment in democracy. Right? In democracy. That there is a robust definition of democratic polity happening here that recognizes that, in fact, the definition of a citizen, not just in a legal sense, the definition of a citizen is somebody who comes out of the door every morning fully aware of her own giftedness and of the giftedness of her neighbors and spends at least part of the time connecting those gifts in ways that the polis, the public, the community gets stronger at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. It matters that we vote every once in a while. I think particularly these days that matters. But it is much more important what we do on a day-to-day basis as occupiers, fellow occupiers of the public space together. So that became for me a little bit of a lesson in democracy. You've been trying to jump in.
Oh, well, I just, at the beginning of this talk, we were talking about inclusion, the center, and inclusion movement as a different, as a paradigm for welcoming strangers, and it occurred to me, then the center would change.
Yeah.
Sort of answered my, with your stories and everything, you sort of answered what was sort of inciting about that.
Yes.
But then it seems like there's enormous implications to that.
That's right, the center looks a lot different.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Your story of the soup kitchen reminded me of something I saw on TV. There's a restaurant in Colorado run by a couple, and I don't recall the name, but there's no prices on the menu. And it's donation, strictly donation. And people were interviewed, and there were homeless people, and they really just felt great because they could actually get a meal and sweep up or do the dishes or something and earn their food, as opposed to just being given handouts.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of the same thing, and you know, it was just, you know, some people, you know, pay $20 for their burger,
yeah,
or whatever. Other people didn't have any money or a quarter.
Yeah.
But it was kind of that community.
Absolutely.
Same kind of concept.
Absolutely. Let me just say the obvious thing here. There's no better place on earth, I think, to be thinking about this stuff in these terms than Holden Village. Right? And this is what makes Holden go in lots of ways. So the question partly is, Are there tools and strategies and perspectives that we can take from Holden back into some real life situations, which might be a little bit more difficult in some ways, that are applicable in those communities as well? Gloria?
Is there any religious component to any of that?
Well, this is all church people. They did this out of a faith base.
Yeah. Were there table prayers? Were there things like that that these people?
They didn't formalize that at the soup kitchen. But what happened, in fact, as some of the outcomes of this process, was that a lot of the people came to the church or came to other religious congregations in the community or joined the choirs in the congregations. Others got plugged into the community, not necessarily through the church. So this particular one had a lot of faith overlay. But I think it's perfectly logical for that to happen, but it doesn't have to come from a faith perspective. Yeah.
Is my church, we're an emerging church, and having a lot of people that, you know, never came to church. And one of our things, our pastor is directs everything as being somebody to be called a minister. You're a minister. A lot of people never been termed that way.
That's right.
You know, you're a minister to the people we serve. So that was just a term that, you know, sort of grabbed somebody that, what is that? Why would I be that or that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's one of the things I love about a lot of African-American churches. Almost everybody who comes is a minister of something, right? And, you know, they're constantly making up new categories to make sure that everybody is a minister of something, which I think is terrific. Yeah?
Where can we get a copy of that thing you just read about, the questionnaire?
That's in a number of our publications, and I can give you the ways to connect to that.
Is it online or anything?
You know, I think it is probably available in our, we just redone our website, so I think it probably is at this point.
The Holden website or one for you?
ABCD Institute, let me put it up. Well, the bell has rung, so let me thank you for your patience in the sauna here.